back together again. You and I, fresh week, Monday, March 13th, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We kicked off the new week with University of New Haven, Department of Economics and Business Analytics senior lecturer Dr. Brian Marks returning to the show to talk about the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. I also had an early warning for Connecticut Republicans ahead of the 2024 election cycle. And you know, when you get into the news cycle, you start to hear phrases that millions of Americans have never heard before. And the one we're hearing right now is Silicon Valley Bank, right? SVP. It's been burned into our collective craniums over the past two or three days because of a very serious issue. Listen, it's not often you see a bank go under and then the inevitable fears begin. The White House saying, hey, calm down. By the way, we'll have some of those remarks later on from President Biden earlier today. But what does this all mean? This is when I defer to the experts and go to the people with much better business cards. Then I return visit by Dr. Brian Marks, senior lecturer in the Department of Economics and Business Analytics at the Pompeia Business School at the University of New Haven. Hey, Brian, it's Paul again. How are you?
I'm doing well for a rainy impending nor'easter.
Yeah, yeah. Aren't
no complaints there.
Yeah, aren't we all? Listen, explain what's going on here, Brian. First of all, Silicon Valley Bank. Did I see something like they're the 15th or 16th biggest bank in the country? Explain this whole thing.
No, you're absolutely. They're one of the larger banks. They're ranked at least before the debacle of last Friday, the 16th largest bank, although I've seen reports 18th. But in any event, they had about $200 billion of assets, mm-hmm. Deposits, if you will, under its management and control. So that's quite substantial. The bank grew significantly during the pandemic and in one sense was flush with cash, but had a mismatch between its short-term cash requirements, as exhibited last week, and its long-term maturity issues, hold-to-maturity notes that it held. And when it needed to call and come up with cash, it wound up losing $1.8 billion.
Wow.
by being forced to basically liquidate its position in instruments that are secure but didn't match the liquidity timing of the imperative of meeting cash requirements of about $42 billion from its customers.
So, Brian, is it accurate also that I did read that SVP is one of these banks? It's not really a widely known bank like one of the big banks. And what they did is they kind of specialized in some high-risk loans and were a favorite of these tech startups. Did you read that as well?
Well, let's. I'm familiar with Silicon Valley Bank, SVB.
Yeah.
It started out on the West Coast. Its presence was not limited to the West Coast, but in fact, at one period of time, people referred to SVB East.
Okay.
We also know they had a subsidiary in the United Kingdom, which, by the way, was acquired by HSBC, that subsidiary. So that's off the books. But they specialize particularly as a lender to high-tech businesses, mm-hmm. startup companies in particular, a favorite of many venture capital firms. And part of the deal, so to speak, in many of the transaction documents is they would also serve as your bank to hold your deposit.
Mm-hmm.
So you borrowed money and you were also required to maintain your deposits at the bank. So it is a niche player and focused more on the commercial side, and hence many people, at least here in the New England region, although those up is Silicon Parkway, we used to refer to it as part of Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
and then Route 128 up in Massachusetts, a lot of people are familiar with Silicon Valley Bank. It's just not the normal commercial retail customer on Main Street in Fairfield, Connecticut, let's say, that would be familiar with Silicon Valley Bank.
Dr. Brian Marks, one of our go-to guys when it comes to all things economics and financial. Dr. Marks, a senior lecturer in the Department of Economics and Business Analytics at the Pompeia College of Business at the University of New Haven. So, Brian, walk us through what happens here. Now, this supposedly, at least for the news cycle, went down on last Friday, but obviously, I would think, or maybe I'm not sure, I don't know, is there a run-up to this? Does somebody at the bank call the feds and say, hey, we're in trouble? Do the feds make the phone calls? What happened, do you think, here in this whole scenario?
Well, this scenario started, and some people can pinpoint, last Tuesday, I think it was, when Silicon Valley Bank acknowledged in a filing that it had to realize $1.8 billion of loss because of selling of securities to meet cash requirements. Mm-hmm. And so they were working with and reach out to the regulatory authorities to let them know, because it's quite apparent there is an issue here, at the same time feeling the pressure of what's going on. So the regulators, in fact, it was California that stepped in and brought the FDIC in as well on Friday, or actually probably overnight, Thursday night into Friday. So once basically everything stopped, trading stopped on the bank, all transactions stopped, that creates a lot of fear and uncertainty. Mm-hmm. As a general rule, we have insurance of $250,000 per account. Now, what raises the big question is about 90% of SVP's depositors had accounts greater than, so about $175 billion was technically uninsured. Mm. So over the weekend, I'm sure the discussions were occurring among the bank and the various regulatory agencies, Treasury, FDIC, and the Fed, to figure out how to proceed. We have to remember SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, was not designated as a large bank in the category of a JP Morgan Chase, to use that as an example. But what we did find as a result of certain regulations arguably being eased back in 2018, mm-hmm. that enabled Silicon Valley to proceed and arguably take risks that larger banks who are subject to additional scrutiny when it comes to supplemental leverage ratios, liquidity requirements, filing and reporting was not exactly the same. But what we did learn is the government designated Silicon Valley Bank that there was systemic risk situation, and therefore the government can step in and engage in certain extraordinary measures, one of which was to say, don't worry, depositors, not only is the $250,000 protected, but we're going to protect all uninsured deposits. Mm. So that was a big move to try to, you know, restore confidence in the banking system, as well as over the weekend, we saw Signature Bank, another bank on the East Coast in New York, also taken over by the Fed at the insistence, in some senses we could say, the New York State Banking Authority. So, you know, like I said, we found out too big to fail is $200 billion, apparently. It's arguably even less because we saw what happened with Signature Bank. So that's the landscape right now. It's trying to instill calm in the marketplace that the banking system is fine, and that you know, it's, if anything, it's a narrow segment as opposed to in 2008. It was quite widespread, the financial crisis. This is more limited. And if I were at one of these regional banks, I'd be looking to get out ahead of this and not just tell my customers everything's fine. I would tell them exactly the steps that I am taking as your regional bank to ensure our stability, such as leveraging the program that the Fed has put in place, a special lending program that will allow for a one-year loan at pretty favorable rates to provide that stability.
So, Brian, finally, do you think in the end, after everybody looks at this and the dust settles and members of Congress look at this and maybe get beyond the partisan infighting here, do you foresee any changes to the FDIC insurance levels, either the covered amount or the types of amounts? Might that happen here or not?
Oh, I think it's going to, and I like the way you characterized it, if we can get away from the partisan politics and the finger pointing and look at it in a very holistic way, we are likely to see some policy moves. We've now recognized that there are certain risks that that we'll use Silicon Valley Bank as the poster child, were not properly accounted for. There were unrealized losses on the in their financial books and records that they didn't have to mark or were not taking it into account, except when they had to realize that loss by meeting a liquidity requirement. So I fully anticipate it won't happen overnight. In the short term, we're dealing with keeping and ensuring the stability of the banking system. But I expect as we roll out over the course of this year into next year, if we could focus on the issues and recognize there was a mismatch, and how did we mismatch between cash requirements and maturity, and what systems could be put in place, or what should have been done in the current regulatory scheme. But I'm more likely than not expecting we are going to see some changes in reporting requirements and analyses and leverage requirements and liquidity requirements for banks between the $50 and $250 billion range. It's more systemic, potentially could be more of a contagion, if you will.
Dr. Brian Marks, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Economics and Business Analytics at the Pompeia College of Business at the University of New Haven. Brian, good to speak with you again, and I'm sure we'll chat down the road. Thanks for the time. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, and better times ahead.
Yep. Thank you, Brian. Yep. Agreed here, Dr. Brian Marks. Brian, thank you. Now, let me start with this, because I saw this earlier today, and it bears mentioning now, even though we are still just a little less than 2 years away from the 2024 election cycle. And I know there's a tendency to say, geez, we're talking about this again, Paul. Well, we are, because it's in the news, and this affects everyone around here, and people love it. You know, politics, maybe because of what I do and talk radio and a whole bunch of other hosts, it's really become a lot more exciting, more of a sport, shall we say, than ever before. But let's go back to what happened, if we can, for a moment, this past November. Now, we know what happened. President Biden was elected in November. We all know about that. We all know about the, I'm sorry, not this past November, but the November previous to that. But this past November, we had the midterms coming off of the first 2 years of the Biden administration. And frankly, the Republicans didn't do as well as everybody thought they would. All right. But one race that was really a fascinating race that was a lot closer than people thought and picked up national coverage here was the 5th District House race between the incumbent multi-term Democrat Johanna Hayes and Republican George Logan, a former state legislator, currently an engineer with Aquarion Water. And it was close, and in the end, Johanna Hayes was able to win. All kudos to her. And I think the final margin, the plurality for Congresswoman Hayes, was about a half point, if I'm right. It was something like, and I guess I could pull it up here, it was something like 50.5 to 49.5. But this was really close. You had a multi-term Democratic incumbent in a blue state, albeit in the state's probably most conservative area, have to put the pedal to the metal here and fend off a challenge by a guy who, by all standards, was kind of a centrist, clear-thinking Republican. And I think you could see what his commercials said and what he has said in debates and his legislative record. Well, apparently you folks in the 5th, and you Connecticut Republicans out there, of which I'm one of them, I will freely admit I'm a registered Republican, which is why I take interest in this stuff. We're going to get a do-over, apparently. Not this race per se right now, but it looks like in the next year and change, when we come up to the 2024 cycle, which will be a big presidential race, and it'll be also a congressional federal election race, House and one-third of the Senate, we are going to get a do-over here. We're going to get another chance to see if a Republican, if any Republican, can win just one seat, not just here from Connecticut's 5-member congressional delegation, but win one seat in New England. Now, it was close last time. It was, you know, about a point, 50 and change to 49 and change, I believe. But would that have been a win for George Logan? And finally, at least one member of Connecticut's House delegation have an R next to his or her name if there wasn't a down ticket drag on the GOP vote? Or more likely or more properly, did someone on the ticket and that person's political leanings prior to the election, did that cost the Republicans a race that probably would have gone the other way and should have, right? Well, we'll get another chance to look at that, and maybe the Republicans are getting a do-over here, just maybe. And maybe Republican voters, not so much the state party, they do what they do, but maybe Republican voters should clear their heads and look at this logically. All right, you Connecticut Republican voters out there, especially you voters who vote in the primaries, listen to me very carefully. You screwed it up this past cycle, thinking for whatever reason in some drug-induced or alcohol-induced haze, that for whatever reason, Leora Levy would be a more attractive candidate than Themis Claridis. I mean, Leora Levy lost by, what, 12, 13, 15 points? She got blown out of the water by Dick Blumenthal, a guy who was only at about 51 or 52% approval in all these polls. And why am I mentioning this? Well, you cannot convince me. You cannot convince me that had Themis Claridis been the nominee instead of Leora Levy, and this is nothing against Mrs. Levy, I don't know her, I've never spoken to her, I'm sure she's a fine woman, she's worked for the state GOP, she looks to be a fine mother and grandmother, whatever, this has nothing to do with her personally. But you coddled up to somebody who had money, what a shock. Gee, the Republicans going for somebody with money? I'm just shocked. Stunned, he said, as he got up from getting knocked over with a feather. And you got somebody who coddled up and cuddled up to Donald Trump when, in fact, in a blue state like this, Donald Trump was kryptonite for white female suburban voters or the voters who decide elections. So you're not going to convince me that if the nominee was Themis Claridis or anybody else who didn't coddle up to Donald Trump, that George Logan probably would have won that race in the 5th. I mean, he lost, and by the way, I did pull up the actual number. Johanna Hayes won that battle against George Logan 50.4% to 49.6%. So 0.8 of 1 point. Separated Johanna Hayes, the incumbent Democrat in the 5th, and George Logan, the Republican challenger. 0.8 of 1 point. Now, you for 50.4 to 49.6. No, now, you don't think that had the Republicans nominated a woman, a white suburban female woman, you don't think that George Logan would have been at least 0.8 of a point higher? You don't think that by nominating Leora Levy and her cuddling up to Donald Trump, you don't think that that cost the Republicans at least 0.8 of a point? Or let's round it up. Let's say it's a point. You don't think so? Come on. Common sense. So again, why am I mentioning this? Because the Republican Party, the House Republicans today, have announced 37 Democratic target seats for the 2024 cycle. 37. Now, are they going to win 37? No. They probably have a ranking internally of which ones are winnable and which ones aren't. And one of the ones that they have listed, again, is CT05, the 5th District race, Greater Waterbury, Greater Danbury, in the Northwest Hills. Litchfield County up there, a race that was almost won by George Logan. So you don't think that George Logan would have been at least 0.8 of a point higher had the state Republicans nominated a nominee that would have made a whole boatload more sense in Themis Claridis than they did by nominating Leora Levy? So, you know, what are Republican voters in this state going to do next time around? Are they going to toss away what looks to be another golden opportunity here if George Logan runs again? It's my sense he might. I don't know. Campaigns are very expensive, and they take tolls on people. But you look at this list released today from the National Republicans, and if they list the 5th District here in Connecticut as a district they're counting on, you know what that means? It means money. It probably means money, as a lot of money came in from the National Republicans heading into the race this past November. So the question begs, are Connecticut's primary voters, again, on the Republican side, and I'm sorry if you don't like me saying this, are they going to blow it again? Again. Are they going to nominate somebody who is only going to be nominated because they coddle up to Donald Trump? I don't know. I'm asking you Republicans out there. You tell me, because you screwed it up last time. Not only did Leora Levy lose, and anybody with half a brain knew she had no shot in that race. And again, I'm not saying she's a bad person. I'm looking at this squarely from a political point. Her campaign disappeared late in the campaign. She had to spend all that money. Now, granted, some of it was hers. I get that. She can do whatever she wants with her hard-earned money or from her investments. But she had to spend all that money just for name recognition, which is something that Themis Claridis had. But again, you know, a lot of people said, well, she voted for this gun bill and that gun bill. Okay, that's fine. Well, you know, she was pro-choice. Okay, that's fine. Well, you got Dick Blumenthal again for 6 years. So what is it going to be this time around in 2024? So again, the National Republican Party, you folks here in the state, you Republican primary voters, who a lot of times you seem to think you know more than the party. Thank you very much. You know, had you had half a brain, we might be talking about Governor Mark Boughton in his second term instead of Ned Lamont. So again, I'll ask you up front, are you going to coddle up to and vote for a nominee, and I have no idea who the nominee might be, in 2024 for the U.S. Senate or for the House? But I'm telling you, if you want a chance, now you're not going to win the Senate race because Chris Murphy is a shoo-in for the race. He's a shoo-in. I know there'll be a nominee. He or she'll be a sacrificial lamb. But dear Lord, that nominee had better not be a Trump acolyte, or we will blow the Republican Party in the state, not necessarily the party, but the voters, will blow up. Just trash another golden opportunity to perhaps, perish the thought, vote with your brain and actually win something.